I've often said that I think the issue of what it takes to bring peace to Israel and in the Middle East on, quote, the Israel question is much simpler than a lot of people realize. But we also want to bring in Michael Rubin. Michael Rubin is with the American Enterprise Institute. He has a superb piece on CNN.com called Why Land for Peace is Dead. He joins me here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Dr. Rubin, thanks very much for making the time this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me, John.
All right. So let me tell you my thesis. Again, I think that peace in the Middle East is simpler, but not easy, than a lot of people realize. And that is, every time that Israel trades land for peace with a country that recognizes its legitimacy as a nation state, whether it's Egypt in 1978 or Jordan to the east in 1994, the deal for the most part holds. But every time they walk away from land without making a treaty with someone who recognizes the right to exist, like when they moved from southern Lebanon, or they walked away from Gaza in 2005, all they get is grief. So in the future, Israel should not make any kind of land for peace deals or give up any land unless they are doing it with the clear, verifiable assurance that the people who are going to live on that land and govern that land will recognize Israel's right to do the same.
You know, I largely agree with you, John. The one question that's going to come out of this, however, is Egypt's actions. Because if Egypt is either using Hamas in Gaza as a proxy, and remember, those missiles had to get into the Gaza Strip somehow, and the number one culprit is probably the smuggling tunnels from Egypt's Sinai Peninsula into the Gaza Strip, or if Egypt continues to allow militants to fire rockets from Egyptian-controlled Sinai Peninsula into Israel, then it raises questions about whether the Egyptians truly see their 1979 peace agreement with Israel as sacrosanct, or whether they interpret it more as a truce, which can be amended at any point in the future.
Okay, now for our listeners who don't have a map in front of them, let's designate that Gaza is that strip of land between Israel and Egypt, to the north of Egypt, to the south of Israel. Israel used to control Gaza, but walked away, even forcibly relocating many of its own residents, closing down entire Jewish neighborhoods, saying we can't protect you here anymore, and made it a de facto homeland for the Palestinians who lived there. They, in turn, elected as their governing representative Hamas, a terror organization whose constitution does not recognize Israel's right to exist.
That's absolutely right. It goes a little bit further than that, however, in that Hamas actually refuses to stop its struggle, its so-called resistance, at the Gaza Strip or at the occupied territories. They want to reconquer all of Israel, not only Israel territorially. If you look up online Hamas's founding principles, they can be somewhat genocidal in nature when it comes not to Israelis, but even more broadly, Jews. Now, since 2005, you're absolutely right, Ariel Sharon, the former Prime Minister of Israel, in his waning days in office, decided, fine, let's put the Palestinians to the test, and withdrew completely from the Gaza Strip, as you said. So when people today talk about the occupied territories, in reality, the only territory which one can say is occupied is the West Bank. It's more disputed, but even so, you have Israelis there, you have Palestinians there. In the Gaza Strip, you only have Palestinians. One of the biggest bones of contention over the last several years has been the Israeli embargo on the Gaza Strip. They've allowed humanitarian goods to go in.
And they still are.
They insist on inspecting them.
I believe they still are.
Oh, they most certainly are. But one of the big questions, the United Nations a few years ago ruled that Israel's embargo was actually legal. But given that Hamas has already launched, I think today it's crossed the 800 missile mark into Israel, it really does affirm the logic of Israel's embargo. But it also raises a question about how these missiles got into Gaza in the first place.
Okay, a couple of questions. First of all, I thought Egypt had its own problems with Hamas.
Egypt did have its own problems with Hamas, but this is one of the reasons why analysts are taking such a keen interest in the current conflict. Because once Hosni Mubarak, the former president of Egypt, fell, we had as his replacement Mohamed Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood. Now remember, Hamas is actually a Muslim Brotherhood spinoff. The Muslim Brotherhood was a group which formed in Egypt in the 1920s and takes a pan-Islamist view. It seeks to break down national borders and institute Sharia, Islamic law, as the law of the land. Now, since Mohamed Morsi has come to power, it seems that smuggling into Gaza has increased. One of the other problems is, on several occasions, we've had terrorists attack from Egyptian-controlled Sinai Peninsula into Israel. Now, the reason why this is important is as a condition of the 1979 peace agreement between Egypt and Israel, Israel gave back the Sinai Peninsula. The return of that land was completed in 1982. And in exchange, the Sinai Peninsula is supposed to be not demilitarized, but it's not supposed to have deployments of heavy weaponry. What Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt are saying is, if you want us to control this territory, you got to allow us to bring in tank battalions and so forth. The Israelis are saying, no, that fundamentally undercuts the territory.
Such a mistake.
And so now we have another problem on our hands between Egypt and Israel. Remember, Egypt isn't just another Arab country. By population, it's the largest. One out of every three Arabs lives in Egypt.
Michael Rubin is resident scholar, American Enterprise Institute, former Pentagon official. Michael, I was in Israel last year, and one of the things I noticed is that Jerusalem is safer than Seattle. And Seattle is a pretty safe city, as big cities go. Not just in terms of crime statistics, but peace of mind. Just people seem to be more or less at ease. And that is the most surprising thing that I noticed in Israel was just the mood within Jerusalem.
Well, John, that's a relatively new phenomena. And what that's a direct result of is the so-called security wall,
right,
which the Israeli government has built largely on the border between Israel and the West Bank. But, and this is what's subject to dispute, at times they have taken land or enclosed land which the Palestinians will claim. The point from the Israeli perspective, however, is since that security wall went up, suicide bombing has decreased by around 95% in Israel. I lived in Israel doing a postdoc at Hebrew University between 2001 and 2002 at the height of the suicide bombing campaign, and the atmosphere then versus the atmosphere now, I mean, it's the difference between living on Earth and the moon.
Yeah, night and day. But and
exactly.
I think that's one of the reasons for the rocket attacks, that a lot of these explosives would be walked across the border, and they'd be going off in plazas, they'd be going off in restaurants, they'd be going off in schools if they hadn't built that security fence.
That's absolutely right. And one of the arguments which is put out there in the West so often, especially among international diplomats of the United Nations, is that Israel's response is disproportionate. Well, let's put aside the Colin Powell doctrine and the way the United States military operates. Underlying the logic and the complaint of this disproportionality is, well, the Israelis have F-18s, and the Palestinians have these Iranian-supplied rockets, and therefore somehow it's not a fair fight. The implication is if you gave the Palestinians advanced weaponry, advanced missiles, and so forth, instead of launching these rockets at Israel, there'd be a full-blown war.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure it's a very wise decision for people to criticize the disproportionality, let alone the moral equivalence it implies between a sovereign democratic state and a terrorist group.
Dr. Michael Rubin from the American Enterprise Institute is my guest. We have just a couple minutes left. Michael, very simple question now. What does Israel do from here?
Israel wants to avoid a ground invasion of Gaza. They don't want to reoccupy. What the Israelis are going to be assessing is this. Number one, have they knocked out all of Gaza's long-range missiles? Number two, do they know where the short-range missiles are, and can they get at them with aerial bombardment? Number three, while there have been videos on YouTube and so forth about the Iron Dome missile shield and its success in shooting down missiles over Tel Aviv, for example,
yes,
there's actually been several of the 800 missiles that Hamas has fired into Israel. Some have landed, some have caused casualties. The Israelis are going to be looking at the efficacy of the Iron Dome system, and I can guarantee you the Iranians will as well.
Now, the Iron Dome system is, conceptually speaking, a little bit like the old Star Wars SDI system that President Reagan talked about, where you would shoot down, knock down incoming missiles. Or the Scud technology from the Gulf War in the early 90s. How would you grade the defense so far?
Well, really what it does is it vindicates Ronald Reagan's vision. A lot of people said during the Reagan administration it's impossible to shoot down missiles. And what the Iron Dome system does is it not only shoots down missiles. Arguably, the intercontinental missiles are easier to shoot down, especially when they go into space. You see an even trajectory. Hamas's missiles are much more erratic, and so the Iron Dome technology has certainly worked. The question is how well it worked and whether the Israelis can fix the system so instead of having a 70% success rate, it has a 99% or 100% success rate.
I'll tell you what has me very concerned, Michael. And that is whether or not, well, if long-range rocketry becomes an option for the terror war, whether the rockets come from the north, Hezbollah, or from the south, from Hamas, and the airport becomes unstable, where there's genuine fear that flights into El Al or Ben Gurion airport could be struck, that will destabilize the country.
That's absolutely right, and this is what brings in to question the whole notion of land for peace, given what's happening in the Gaza Strip. Because when you look at the geography of Israel, at its narrowest point, Israel is less than 10 miles wide. Now, any flight flying into Ben-Gurion Airport, which is solely on Israeli land, it's not on disputed land, comes close enough to the boundary of the West Bank that a terrorist wouldn't even need a surface-to-air missile to shoot down, for example, a continental air flight into Ben-Gurion International Airport. All they would need is a high-powered rifle, and that's what's so dangerous.
Wow. All right. Dr. Michael Rubin, thanks very much for taking the time. When we talk about Iran, we'd also like to be able to take advantage of your expertise, Michael.
Oh, anytime.
All right. That's very good. That's Michael Rubin from AEI helping to spell out exactly what's at stake here in the Middle East, joining me on Talk Radio 570 KVI.